You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me back to...
Okay, we're going. We're on section 108 of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. We're reading through the book and talking about it and other things. So go ahead.
108. The basic metaphysical positions within the history of the guiding question and the respective interpretations of time-space. 1. How space and time are experienced, grasped, and named in the first beginning. What does mythological interpretation mean here? 2. How both themselves enter into the realm of beings, the realm of what is constantly present and are in part non-being. 3. The fact that the domain of truth for being remains closed off and unknown here. 4. To what extent neither possible nor necessary to think space and time, place and now, back into their origin, appertaining to truth. 5. How space and time then become schematic representations in the course of their interpretation with respect to extension. 6. How this postulation is then appropriated in modern mathematical thinking. 7. How the discrepancy in their essence and in their relation to the I and to consciousness ultimately comes to count in Leibniz and Kant as something fixed and conceptually determined, which happened earlier with the interpretation of beings as, oh, I don't know that Greek word.
It's being.
How even Nietzsche does not ask radical questions here.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, he's looking at how space-time is interpreted in the basic metaphysical positions in the history of the guiding question. The history of the guiding question is, what is being?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a history to the question, what is being? There are basic metaphysical positions inherent in that question, and these positions have different interpretations of time and space. How they are experienced, grasped, and named in the first beginning. So how time and space are delineated in Greek metaphysics. What does mythological interpretation mean here? I think that's really saying that there is a kind of interpretation of Greek philosophy that it is mythological, that it both... is an explication of the myths of the Greek people, but also that there's something almost pre-logical, pre-cognitive, pre-philosophical, pre-empirical to it, that because of the mythological consciousness of the Greeks, they were able to achieve a kind of philosophical grandeur and insight that is not even possible anymore, in terms of at least the discrepancy between the development of their civilization and the power of their insights. How both themselves enter into the realm of being. So I think that's both space and time. How space and time enter into the realm of beings, the realm of what is constantly present, and are in part non-being. So sort of how space and time get inserted into the world of beings and yet don't have being themselves. They're just kind of functions or supernatural conduits or parameters or measures or motivators. The fact that the domain of truth for being remains closed off and unknown here, that's Heidegger's constant comment that we have not really looked into the truth of being. To what extent neither possible nor necessary? To what extent, I think the phrase "it is" missing there. To what extent it is neither possible nor necessary to think space and time back into their origin, appertaining to truth. I think what he's saying is it's not even really possible, maybe, to understand what space and time were to those who developed it, developed the concepts originally, which I guess in this sense would be the Greeks. How space and time then become schematic representations in the course of their interpretation with respect to extension. So, yeah, again, they don't have being, they are schematic representations. That are interpreted as providing and being the determinants of the idea of extension. So extension over time, extension through space. And this becomes, in a sense, mathematical thinking. Mathematics as the extension of number, extension of form, extension of shape. And how the discrepancy in their essence and in their relation to the eye and to consciousness comes to count in Leibniz and Kant as something fixed and conceptually determined. So in other words, space and time come to be the factors that link the self-consciousness to reality. They become the framework through which the eye experiences the world. And it says, which happened earlier with the interpretation of beings as usha. And I think usha means essence. So I think what he's saying is, and that even, that linking of the eye to experience via the framework of space and time was actually already implanted in us conceptually via the Greeks interpreting beings as essence or being. So that, in a sense, implanting form onto the particulars of the world. And not even Nietzsche really gets too radical or extreme in dismantling and deconstructing this thought structure. So, yeah, just kind of some space and time considerations there. You have any comments or?
Not really.
Yeah. I think it just, probably the last thing to say is that, you know, I think, I don't know, somehow for me, space and time and the need to think more profoundly about them or more in depth about them. More specifically about them, has always been a little boring. I think I find space and time philosophy to be rather tedious and a little empty. But I think that really what Heidegger is calling us to do here is to realize space and time might just be really kind of cold analytic words for it, but he's asking us to see the ways in which assumptions about where things are and how they exist, and assumptions about how they last, how they have duration, how they are in the past and then in the future, or how they're present to us. So really, it is truly the primary schemata of experience, these things. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to say that we don't really understand these things, and there's a lot more room for us to go out there and kind of look at them and understand how they frame our world and how we have been ripped away from them. And most importantly, ask why we've been ripped away from them, what the symptoms of that fissure are, and they stand as kind of, in a sense, a little wilderness calling us to come and explore what is more genuinely existent in our world than the ideational representations that we've come to call self-consciousness and meaning. So, yeah, that's it.
Should we do the next section?
Yeah, so we're gonna get into a lot of Greek here.
Yeah,
and I think we have this. You know, the title is idea, and I think we need to understand that that is again the form of Platonism that we often hear about Plato and his forms. It also means the look of a thing, as we've said, and the eidos, or the idea of a thing. So it's a multifarious word, but we're just going to kind of look at it as Heidegger bandies it about, and maybe just keep in mind its multifarious meanings without having to get too deep into what the Greek actually implies. But I think you could just say idea or form, whichever one you want. I kind of like idea.
Yeah.
It just looks like idea.
It does look like idea in Greek. And then should I say aletheia or truth? Because aletheia is the other word.
Yeah, I think truth is fine.
Truth, okay. 109, idea. Is that interpretation of truth which prepares the later determination of beingness as objectivity and necessarily forecloses to the entire history of Western philosophy the question of truth as such. Only another inceptual thinking of being and of its relation to Dasein can give rise to the question of what was called truth in the thinking of the first beginning.
Yeah, so the idea or the forms of Plato, the idea of the form, the essence, the look of things, is an interpretation of truth that inevitably is causal in the determination of beingness as objectivity and forecloses all of Western philosophy to the question of truth. So it sets up a structure, a higher order, a formulaic reality above and beyond time and space, in a sense, and it creates an objectivity and a necessity that we then relate to, and the question of truth, the domain of truth, becomes kind of buried and irrelevant. And so we have to have a new kind of thinking, an inceptual thinking. This needs to be a thinking about being. It needs to be relate to Dasein, and it needs to give rise to the question of what was called truth in the thinking of the first beginning, what truth was then, and how it's come to be thought of. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I guess
this is a lot of Greek, but I guess we got to do some of it.
Yeah, we got to do some. Yeah. Yeah. And as we go through it, I think we need to remember that the reason we're looking at this is that Heidegger very much believes that Plato and his forms have left a 2,500-year heritage of machination, objectivity, ideation, representation that has really left us deluded, denuded, and, as he says, in a sense, without a plight. mesmerized, stuck in objectivity, and it's really destroyed our relationship with time and space and with bang, the eventful world, and that philosophy is in a sense the carrier of this misappropriation of thought into the idea or the form. So yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm just just look at one word. Let's look. Okay. One ten. The idea, Platonism, and idealism. One, the concept of idea, look, the look of something, what something gives itself out to be and makes of itself, that in which something is set back and thus is the being it is. Although idea is related to ideav, the word does precisely not mean the represented of a representing. Ideav is see.
So although idea is related to seeing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how we get the idea of look. Mm-hmm. The idea is the look of something.
The word does precisely not mean the represented of a representing. On the contrary, it means the shining forth of the look itself, what offers up a view and does so for a gaze. The word does precisely not signify a relation to the subject in the modern sense. It refers rather to the presencing, the shining forth of the view in the look, and specifically as that which, in coming to presence, provides constancy at the same time. Here originates the distinction between the what it is, essentia quiditas, and that it is, existentia, in the temporality of the idea. Cf. the leap. A being is a being in virtue of constant presence, idea, the seen in its seenness, truth.
Yeah, so he's just kind of trying to make this cluster of associations. I'm pointing out that the form or the idea is the look of something, the way it looks. And how it gives itself out to be and makes of itself. So that in which something is set back and thus is the being it is. So, you know, it's like that phrase, what's that Prince song? You've got the look, right? The look. It's like the look. The look is something you can make of yourself. You can give yourself out to have it. It emanates from you. It does not mean the represented of a representing. No, that's... on the contrary, it means the shining forth of the look itself. So it doesn't mean when you represent something, what is represented. So it's not so intricately or semantically tied to the representational process and doesn't necessarily gain meaning or representation through the act of representation, but it's more that it's just the look as it shines forth. So he's being sort of very particular here about what the Greeks meant by this word. It's really just, it's a glimmer, it's a view, it's that what is there for the gaze. So in a sense, it is a little devoid of meaning. It's actually more like light, a presence. And it doesn't signify a relation to the subject in the modern sense. So that's a little similar to saying it does not mean the representative or representing. It's not what the subject chooses to mean or how the subject chooses to represent themselves. It refers rather to just the presencing, the making present of the subject, the shining forth of something, of the view and the look, and specifically as that which in coming to presence provides constancy at the same time. So the look is constant, it has presence, it has duration, it's an appearance. And in this, there's a distinction between what it is and that it is in the temporality of the idea. So I'm not sure what he, I guess in the fact that it's just a shining forth. There's a difference between what it is and that it is. So its existence is that it is, and its essence is what it is. A being is a being in virtue of constant presence. Idea, the seen in its seenness. So a being must have presence, it must have constancy, it must be seen in its seenness, which is its truth, and that is the idea of the being. So just kind of, I think he's just trying to set up a kind of a phenomenology of the look of the being and the way that presence and constancy in the shining forth of the existent makes itself known to us. And I couldn't help but sort of think in that very first, the look of something, what something gives itself out to be and makes of itself. I guess I just couldn't help but think of kind of like our identitarian culture in which total existential and civic status is attained by one's look, which, you know, again, as he says here, doesn't really have anything to do with the subject. And doesn't really have anything to do with what is represented. It's more that the look enters into the commerce of empty meaning and accumulates power by according to whatever order is establishing the value of looks. Yeah, go ahead.
Two, the idea, that to which the changing many things are referred back, the unifying one. Therefore, of being is unifying as a consequence with respect to its many instantiations. The idea is the common, is that common? Is the common, and the common, this later derived determination of the idea as beingness, then remarkably becomes the first and ultimate determination of beingness or of being. And so being is the most general. Yet this is not strange. It is necessary because from the beginning on being is experienced and thought as beingness only on the basis of beings, so-called beings, i.e. only on the basis of the many and also back to them.
Yeah, so the idea of things has a unifying power. It's that into which things are changing. It's that that we refer back to. It's the unifier. And this means being is unifying. Being and oneness are kind of the same thing. As a consequence, with respect to its many instantiations, so the idea has many instances or emanations or avatars or instantiations is a good word. The idea is the common, the general. And the general, this later derived determination of the idea as beingness, remarkably becomes the first and ultimate determination of beingness or of being. So that's another way of just saying kind of like being becomes identity, and identity determines being. And so being is the most general, or being is identity. Yet this is not strange. It is necessary because from the beginning on, being is experienced and thought as beingness only on the basis of beings. So-called beings only on the basis of the many and also back to them. So, yeah, a lot of the word a lot of variation of the word being in there. I mean, I think what he's saying is, from the beginning on, so from sort of the first beginning onward, we get a sense of being or essence or just what being is, or the concept of being, is thought as beingness, so as having beingness, as in a sense having being, on the basis of beings, on the basis of the many, and also back to them. So, you know, this plays into what he said before, is that we have come to understand or assume what beings are, and we assign the status of being to things. And there are beings, but they have being. And that being is there because we've determined that that being is inherent to beings. So it's this kind of loop between the objects of the world and our objectification of them, and how that creates an entire object sphere that we understand as having general and specific being, both of which depend on each other for their definition and for our experience of them. But I think most importantly, you know, he's trying to point out that the way we talk about and think about beings ultimately causes what we understand being to be, or misunderstand being to be, and establishes the truth of being without ever asking about the truth of being. So we're kind of skipping a few steps in getting to being via beings. Because in establishing beings without really asking what being is, we're determining something without ever determining what we're using to determine that it is. Yeah, shall we keep reading a little bit?
Yeah. Okay. 3. Once the idea is postulated as the beingness of beings and is conceived as the common, then thought of again on the basis of so-called beings, namely the individuals, the idea must be in relation to these, the highest being, which is most eminently.
What is most eminently?
What is most eminently? The idea especially, indeed the idea alone, satisfies the essence of beingness and may therefore claim to count as what is most eminently a being in the most proper sense. What is individual and changeable thus becomes non-being. Correct?
Yes. That,
i.e. what does not ever satisfy beingness.
Yeah, so idea and form and the look and the objectivity and the representation and the shining forth and the beingness becomes preeminent and eminent and really is what is most fully and in the proper sense. And what is individual and changeable really doesn't have any being. And so we just sort of see how we end up with a world of static, objective beings in that are represented by the idea. And so we get idealism, we get ideology, we get ideation, we get an addiction to and an immersion in permanence and constant presence that is really hard to get out of, because as he says, the so-called individuals and the way we conceptualize individuals, and that doesn't necessarily mean individual persons, but it means any kind of single entity, the way we conceptualize them habitually and consistently, really endemically, embeds our thinking into an objectivity that removes us from understanding truth and even having a genuine relationship to those individuals. Mm-hmm. So there's really just a it's an intimation of kind of brain lock.
Mm, yeah.
A kind of dementia, or like reverse dementia.
I like how you said that, like the obsession with presencing, or what would you say, something like that?
Yeah,
I don't remember. Or addiction to presencing.
Yeah.
4, if being always as beingness common is grasped in this way as one, as what is most eminently and what is one and most unifying, and if the idea themselves are many, then these many as the highest forms of beings can be only in the manner of the common, i.e. in a community among themselves. Therein are gathered the presence and constancy of beingness, i.e. unity, the genera as unities, self-unifying and in that way generators, genera.
Yeah, so we end up with categories, really. Categories of being, genera of being, communities of being, consistencies of being, clusters, groups, forms, generators of being. Yeah, self-unifying communities. I mean, that's pretty clear, right? Mm-hmm. We go from just like the forms of being to the formations of formulated being and conforming being, formative forms of being, communities of being. And that's when we start to really, feel that kind of that so-called communities and categories and groups and clusters and identity formations gain and establish and enforce their reality and their presence as predominant and overarching and as the only kind of forms that knowledge is allowed to take. We have a lot of that today. It's quite the thing. The next one is a big one. I mean, maybe we've read enough Greek for the day.
Sure. I mean, we'd have to stop.
We don't even know.
We'd have to stop and
That's a big one. Maybe we'll just research the Greek before we dive in next time.
Yeah, sounds good.
This is there's 14 of these sections, and the Greek is thick.
Yeah.
And then there's even some German later. But we're going to read every word, and it's all very exciting. It's good stuff. It's really thick philosophy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think there's obviously a lot in here about identity and mm-hmm. community and mm-hmm. group and beingness and the way that the liberal order has come to accept these forms and these ideas as predominant and eminent and defendable and progressive and rigorous.
Constant. Necessary.
Critically sound. Yeah, peer reviewed.
Yeah.
There was this little stink this week about the, I think it's called like the Association of Unified, the American Association of Unified Professors or something. It's like a professional organization for professors and universities. And they were being attacked for, the lack of viewpoint diversity in academia. And they put out a tweet that said, fascism doesn't do well under peer review, as a kind of a jibe to say there's a reason there are no conservatives in academia, and it's because fascism doesn't do well under peer review. Of course, communism does really great under peer review, apparently. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, we all know the difference between communism and fascism, right? Like that's obvious. So it's just these ideas, these forms, these structures of thought, these politicized fortresses mm-hmm. of meaning that people use now. It's really awful. But I don't know. Heidegger's just kind of giving a real masterclass here in the dissection of these of the underlying cognitive structures that make all this possible. Mm-hmm. I'm not really quite sure what to say about it. I mean, I think I want you to talk. I've been talking a lot, but I mean, I think.
Oh, please. Maybe
we talk about liberal to post-liberal, that pivot from liberal to post-liberal.
Yeah.
Is there anything in this reading that you feel like gives us any sense of what that, any more markers for what that pivot means, what that pivot is?
I feel like he's talking mainly about the liberal in this section.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Yeah, I agree.
Completely like it. So.
I agree.
So I guess which is what you just said, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess there's some hints here where he talks about, you know, the beings or the so-called beings or the individuals. I mean, you can kind of take a lot of what he's saying in its negative and kind of get a sense for what the post-liberal might be looking at. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems that he's calling us to have a more immediate analysis of space and time. Mm-hmm. He's questioning constant presence.
Yeah.
And the idea that non-being is that whatever does not have constant presence. So it does seem like a post-liberal mindset. I hate to use that word, but you know, that a post-liberal.
Can you say it again? Non-being is what does not have constant presence.
Yeah.
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 I mean, constant presence is just, it's a really big one.
Yeah. Tell me why. What do you mean?
I mean, it's just, I think that's just what thinking makes possible and form an idea. It just makes everything constantly present.
Yeah.
All the time. All you have to do is have like a little like flicker of it and it's like all there.
Yeah.
And it pulls up so much.
Yeah. And there's a lot of labor done in our world to make sure that constant presence is constantly present.
Yeah.
Because it's the kind of thing that doesn't happen without labor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not, I guess, so what would be the post-liberal version of constant presence? I guess time, space, specificity, perhaps, or...
Yeah, and I think there's somewhere in here he talks, he uses a phrase, I mean, I mean, obviously, sort of, you know, the opposite of constant presence would be sort of the more fleeting and the non-being that he says in here. Here it is: the individual and changeable. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think that, you know. We've talked a little bit about this, but I mean, there's so much in Heidegger about understanding what we're looking at when we're looking at an object, mm-hmm. or what our experience of the object actually is outside of the look or cognition of the essence of the object or the essencing of the object that happens to us habitually and naturally at this point. I mean, so the individual and the changeable... are what are kind of hidden, mm-hmm. much like he says truth is hidden. And so it's about pushing aside the labor and the manufacture of constant presence and looking for the individual and the changeable, and kind of understanding objects, although I'm not sure we have a, it'd be nice if there's a better word. I mean, event in a sense is the right word. Mm-hmm. That are subverting and in a way just have a more a more flirty and fleety relationship to constant presence. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a very difficult question to say, well, so what on earth, how on earth could we experience something that is not constant or present? And that's tough to say. I mean, but I think that it definitely feels ungrounded to claim that we can only experience constant presence. I'm not sure if we can know non-constant non-presence, but it seems at least possible that we experience it, mm-hmm. and that it affects our knowing and affects our thinking and is there. I mean, we've come to think that what is there is only what is constantly present, mm-hmm. but there's no law in nature that states that's the case. Mm-hmm. So I think going to space and time, and we've talked a little bit at times about having a more timeful relationship to what things are, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we're talking about time as a verb. Mm-hmm. So that feels very post-liberal to me. Space and time become schematic representations in the course of their interpretation with respect to extension. I think space and time not being schematic representations I think them becoming schematic representations is very liberal, mm-hmm. but that sort of negates them of being and makes them, in a sense, just, as I said, like sort of unanalyzable and assumedly necessary functions of perception. But in fact, space and time are a lot more intricate and interesting than just that. I think he says here, in their relation to the I and to consciousness. I mean, so much of what I talk about identity as being, meaning same, you know, that the scalp, sameness, yeah. category, labeling, projection, these are all very, these require space and time as schematic representations that can be controlled and maintained. We talked in the last episode mm-hmm. about duration. Liberalism is really fixated on the duration of things. For instance, identity is simply ideological duration. Mm. Identity is simply durational idea, durational form, durational category, duration. Like, there's no identity without duration, because identity is the duration of ideas over time and across space.
The constancy of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, identity is basically the supposition and the postulation and the labor required to procreate the idea that one is the same over space and time. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is. And of course one is perhaps somewhat the same over space and time. And of course one is perhaps also not the same over space and time. But identity is the brushing aside of these equivocations in order to solidify the I and consciousness into identity's formula. Mm-hmm. So I think a post-liberal movement would be dismantling the time-space schema of the I and of consciousness, and letting time-space exist outside of the I, and questioning the duration-based ideation of identity, mm-hmm. And not letting yourself be put on the cattle car of identity, mm-hmm. because when you're put on that car, you are ingratiated to durational consciousness, and you are informed into identitarian constancy, and you really lose your own time and your own space. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'd say post-liberalism is staying off that car, mm-hmm. and trying to stay free of identity, stay free of the durational obsession of liberalism, and and to find a consciousness and an I that don't have anything to do with the invagination of time-space formulas that are actually about removing you from time and space. I mean, liberalism is a reason you can die and say, I never really lived. You know?
Say more.
How can you say you've never really lived as you're about to die? Because you obviously lived. but you don't have the sensation of having lived. You don't have the feeling of having lived. You don't have the a memory or a kind of visceral echo of experiencing time and space and being where you were.
Yeah.
And that's because you were liberalized and therefore you were living in a fake objectivity.
Totally. That's well said.
So post-liberalism is about...
I feel like that about things. like when I look back on stuff, I'm like, was I even like really in... I don't know. Was I enjoying it? Was I pulled out in some way? And you know, when they have stories that are like, what does the person on their deathbed say to the whatever?
And right.
Those things always come up.
What comes up?
Just the idea of to actually live life as opposed to somehow not live it while living it.
Yeah. Well, that's why the most important liberal mantra is be here now.
Yeah, right.
Because you can't be.
Yeah.
And so be here now is the industry of getting people to pay other people
to help them
do something that is impossible in the system in which the interaction took place.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And the roles and the problems and the solutions and the medicines are all pre-established to not work because they are liberalism. And so be here now is futile within a liberal context. So the post-liberal context removes be here now as a mantra and actually makes be here now as a form of truth. Or a quest for understanding the meaning of truth. I mean,
that's what I kind of say is, isn't be here now like kind of be present?
Be here now. Yeah, that's the thing. I think be here now in a liberal context means be constantly present.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, let's be present. Oh, you hear that in yoga class all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, let's be present. And so we're supposed to sort of achieve this durational performance of ourselves as lasting over time, and like you're supposed to feel like, I mean, the mandate of presence is really that, like, okay, oh, I'm here now, look at me here now, wait, I'm still here now, and I'm here now, and I'm here now, and I have memory of having been there then, but it's here now, and I'm still here now, and I'm still here, and so I'm still here. But that none of that is actually being here now. Being here, to be here now, means you're not trying to be here now. You are here now. Or you're actually, but by the way, what is here, what is now, and what is be? And, you know, in liberalism, those all have very specific meanings, none of which really actually have much to do with the breadth and, in a sense, what Heidegger uses that phrase, the mythological nature of those concepts. I think the idea that you could snap your fingers and be here now is really kind of that's pretty liberal. That it's just a flip of the switch, or it's just a change of the mind, or it's just a setting of the intention. I'm going to intend to be here now.
Well, I feel like what it really means is that your mind isn't like going off and like thinking about your to-do list or worrying about something. It's really also just this like supposed...
It's a lunch break.
Yeah,
but I mean, how hollow is that? How like not really be here now is that?
Yeah, right.
I just don't think we know what be here now means. And I think post-liberalism is actually, I think, a really good place to start in asking what be here now is and what it means and how we actually do it. I think in liberalism, be here now kind of means like, let's stop being liberal for a second. Not liberal, liberal political, but just let's act as if all of a sudden all that liberal stuff is gone.
Like, let's all be Buddhists for a little
bit. Yeah, exactly. We're just here right now.
And then we can go.
And then we won't be. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's a kind of a little, it's a strange little place.
Well, I think like what's always been, somewhat like sort of contradictory to me is this idea that in a way we are looking for presence, but we're not looking for constant presence, or we are looking to like, you know, have experienced life, but we're not looking for lived experience. So like, and I think you just put it well by saying like, well, like I think that the general mass claim to these things of lived experience and be here now are very like they're like you can't achieve them in the structure that's been set up. I think that's very well said. That it's just you can't. Or maybe you achieve some version of it, like you don't think about your anxiety during your hour-long yoga class, and then you consider it a success. But was that actually being there? And was it a success, really? Or was it just setting you up to like mess it up more later?
Exactly. And is liberalism just a system that sets up constant presence that in fact is incessant fiction or obsessive avoidance in order to create a kind of sense of a lack of being here now so that it can then mantraize and monetize be here now.
Yeah.
You know, which is also a smokescreen to cover up its own offenses against the ability to be here now. So it becomes a spiritual mandate. And, you know, in the sense then, it fetishizes and inflates the idea of constant presence and makes it a necessity and an obsession. But I think that the post-liberal approach is that there can be constancy, there can be presence, and there can be constant presence, but it is not inherently valuable because once you shed that liberal economy, constant presence is just kind of like one option of many. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's not like a constant presence within the liberal mindset is the highest value. Mm-hmm. Once you leave the liberal mindset, you can take or leave constant presence. Mm-hmm. It's just all of a sudden, it's like literally trying to spend a drachma in Canada. You know, it's just not the currency of the nation you're in. Mm-hmm. You don't need it. It doesn't work. You're not getting anywhere with it. You can take it or leave it. You might use it if you go back to wherever the drachma is accepted. Mm-hmm. So, is drachma a currency? I don't know.
I don't know. I've never heard
drachma.
Of it.
Drachma. I can't even know what country. I think it is. I just don't know what country it is. Uh-huh. Greece, maybe? Anyhow. So it's that so, way.
Sorry. Yeah,
no, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, please.
It's just the way that liberalism sets up vacuums so it can charge you to fill them.
Mm-hmm. And so it can make it that you can't actually fill them with what it's provided.
Right.
With the context that you're in.
Right.
I feel that very strongly about obviously like anxiety stuff. I'm like, it's just not possible to actually solve it within the context of
well, it doesn't liberalism. Dare solve it. It would all fall to pieces.
Yeah.
Liberalism can't solve its own problems. Because then liberalism would go away.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the last thing it wants to do.
Yeah. Totally. So then I think getting back to the idea of, you know, a life, like how do you say it's a, that you've lived life or how do you live life if it's, what are the markers or features or...
To me,
I think questioning is definitely one.
Yeah. Questioning is good, yep. Yep. To me, I think... and linked to questioning is, for me, this... Liberalism has a massive list of all the things that you're supposed to consider valuable to experience. Mm-hmm. And I want to know what every single one of those are so I can ask myself, am I trying to experience them because liberalism has told me they're important to experience? Mm-hmm. Or do I really want to experience them because I actually enjoy them and they are fulfilling and they make me feel alive? Because most of the things that liberalism tells me I should be experiencing in order to be alive make me feel absolutely dead. And so I have to understand what liberalism's scripture and prescriptions are for living the good life, because by and large, that's exactly what you don't want to be doing.
Yeah.
Because liberalism is not interested in you living the good life. Liberalism is primarily interested in destroying beauty.
Why?
because beauty is offensive, oppressive, and enviable.
Yeah, right.
And real, and most importantly, beauty is time, space, and immediately experienceable outside of liberalism. Beauty cannot be captured and appropriated by liberalism, so it drives liberalism insane.
That makes me think of what people would say, like early on about my artwork, that part of the reason galleries didn't like it was because the commerce structures were outside of the gallery structure.
Exactly.
So it's like, if you're operating outside of the structure, then there's no point for the structure to support it in any way.
Absolutely not. No, the structure wants to destroy it.
Yeah.
The structure wants it gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So post-liberalism is looking for beauty to experience, because experiencing beauty, it will prevent you from lying in your deathbed and saying I never lived.
Joy is another word that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Similar, maybe.
So post-liberalism obviously wants to partake in an inceptual thinking of being and its relation to Dasein, giving rise to the question of what was called truth in the thinking of the first beginning. So post-liberalism, and in another way, that's just saying post-liberalism is a dedication to Heidegger's project of asking the question of what is truth, and thinking about being in relation to Dasein, not in relation to constant presence. And Dasein is an interesting, I would say, juxtapositionary concept to constant presence. Dasein is not constant presence. I would say Dasein is a constant contingence. It's the impermanence of intuition and intention. And it's being in time and space with the event. And it's being appropriated by the event. And when you are appropriated, you have no idea how constant and how present that experience is going to be. But you do it because it's the only way to say, I didn't live on your deathbed.
I did live, yeah.
Yeah, the only way to say, only way to avoid saying I didn't live, exactly.
Yeah.
So we then get to the concept of idea, the look of something, what something gives itself out to be and makes of itself, that in which something is set back and thus is the being it is. You know, again, I just read that and I just immediately thought about identity, race communism, the look of things, ethnicity, the color of your face, the story of your people, the way you look, La, la, la. Yeah, I mean, there was a rally from Amdani last night, and AOC was there, and, you know, she's a total race hoe, of course, a race whore. you know, she gave this speech where she, you know, New York was built by the Irish person running from this, and by the Puerto Rican doing this, and by the Muslim doing this, and by the black man doing this. It was this like long laundry list of everybody according to ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And it just makes you throw up when you hear it. I mean, it's just just the look of people is so critical to high liberalism. It's disgusting. So although ideas relate, so it's all.
Well, and isn't that like very apparent in Mamdani himself in that?
Yeah. I mean, Mamdani is a race communist. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Well, but also just like that he is like Muslim, right? Like, so he looks the part.
Yeah.
Or Arabic. He looks the part, I guess, but he grew up in a completely cushy.
Oh yeah. Of course like, he did. Yeah.
Upper.
Yeah.
Class New York experience. So yeah. It was just kind of, yeah. So that's like a great example of how like the look.
Yeah, exactly.
Doesn't reflect.
A look means nothing. It is not the representative representing. Yeah, it has nothing to do with the subject.
Yeah.
It's just currency in the market. Yeah.
And the most important currency for the look.
For identitarianism. Idea. Yeah, of course. Yeah. And so post-liberalism does not organize the world according to looks.
Mm-hmm.
It's not interested in the look of something. It looks through the look, actually. Liberals peddle the look. Post-liberalism devalues the look and throws it away, throws the look away.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say really quickly, sorry, one more thing on that topic. I heard a speech, part of his speech, and he was, you know, talking about how he was made to feel different. And it reminded, or that like, you know, a school teacher of his was like, you could have some bullying because of something. And it remind, because he's colored.
It's hard to be him, definitely, yeah.
But it reminded me of growing up Jewish and being told basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Which was... like, you know, or just that you're different, you're other, and just like that proclivity to do that to ourselves, or I mean,
yeah,
for identities to do it to themselves is like also just
it's masturbating to your own victimhood, really.
Sorry, that was a tangent.
That's okay. Yeah, it's all fun, it's all wonderful. Yeah, so we have the ideas unifying. And again, that's identity. I mean, to say something like, you know, the Muslim this, the black man this, the Irish man this, blah, blah, blah. That's just a genera. So yeah, we get to this idea of the genera, right? Mm-hmm. And the unifying and the form and the generality of things. And we only relate to things in generalities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the idea that there are people out there who, when they hear some kind of like... ethnic grouping feel like they're there, like it's them, like is embarrassing, of course. You know, as he says here, the individual gets lost, the individual and the changeable becomes a non-being. So really, without that group identity, you're a non-being. You're cast out, you're exiled into an infinite darkness. So the genera, I mean, an identity is nothing but a genera. It's a generality. It's a generator of self-unity. And so I think the post-liberalism rejects these genera, rejects these generators of beingness, and relates to the individual and the changeable. Yeah. Anything else?
I have a little parenting. I don't know.
Sounds absolutely. I'm in a lovely change of topic.
It's related to what I was saying.
Yeah, sure.
But so my parents are coming to visit, and they are excited to visit over Hanukkah. And part of it, I'm sure, is to make sure that our young children have the experience of lighting the candles and
doing
presents. I mean, they've basically said that. No, I think
it's a total accident.
Well, no, they're coming over Hanukkah. As I was thinking about it, and it's our son, because I think he watches YouTube. He sometimes will ask for Christmas music, right? Or
he's what?
Hasn't he asked for like Christmas music for you to play it? Or he'll like mention Christmas or something. And I was thinking about it. I was like, I really think I want to celebrate Christmas as well. Like, I don't want to do Hanukkah, not Christmas. Like, I don't want to say to him, sorry, no. You don't get those decorations. You don't get to like feel like you like those songs. You don't get, cause he's so innocently excited about jingle bells. But like, I mean, if I was a real Jew, I would say, I'm sorry, that's not, I don't know. That's not your song. You know, you're not really supposed to be excited about that. We're not singing that here. But yeah, that was my most recent sort of thought on the topic, because we've talked a bit about the holidays and what to do. And we're also maybe going to create our own family holiday as well.
Oh, yeah. I'm gearing
up. You're gearing up. Awesome. So I think that will make for a very lovely holiday season, like all three.
Yeah, I'm all for that. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, like, I literally don't have the heart to say to him, sorry, that's not. Feel mean?
Yeah, I mean, that would be weird, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's only three, and I do think there will come a day when we're able to say to him, what do you want to celebrate?
Yeah, totally.
And then he gets to decorate the house, mm-hmm. and he gets to, and, you know, he'll probably want to celebrate everything because it means more presents. I mean, yeah. Why not, you know?
Yeah.
So it does seem likely that would be his wish. And that seems cool to me.
Yeah.
You know, he has family. He has family members who celebrate Hanukkah. He has family members who celebrate Christmas. And he has me who celebrates an as yet unnamed, you know, festivity. So he has a lot of influences.
Yeah.
And there, I agree with you, there's really no reason to reject any of them.
Yeah.
It would be...
It is wild, though, the extent to which, like, Halloween, right? It's a he's so excited for Halloween, and he has all this mythology already around it. And it hasn't even happened, but he just like sees all this stuff. And so it like feels very, I think, comforting. They're like stories he's familiar with or things he really like gets. I guess that's what all holidays maybe are like, but
yeah.
It's kind of amazing to me just the extent to which it being a story that he can understand is also adds just comfort and value.
Yeah.
Which is a little unnerving in a way, but also kind of fun.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's the height of general, but it also, I don't know, maybe it's not. Maybe it is.
The height of general? What do you mean?
Yeah, like the common or general or community holidays.
Yeah. I mean, we're all born into families and we do that kind of stuff, you know. I don't know. I feel like it's the kind of thing that's cool to do. People do it. People celebrate different holidays, you know. I think holidays are cool. I mean, I'm not against them.
Yeah.
I think every clique of people has different holidays. I mean,
yeah.
It does seem to me that a lot of my ranting against identity, I think I need to be sure and stipulate that what I'm really talking about is infiltration of, I guess, civic, intellectual, and aesthetic spheres with identitarian considerations.
Mm-hmm.
But if people want to, revel in the memories of their culture in their free time,
mm-hmm.
I think that's a perfectly wonderful thing to do. I think there are intellectual, civic, and aesthetic ways of being that, if we really thought about them, could be set up to be trans identity.
Yeah.
Meaning they're not determined by what identity you are. And I mean, I've used that phrase race communism a couple of times in this podcast. You know, sort of race communism is the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's determining the political through identity. It's determining the intellectual through identity. It's determining the aesthetic through identity. That is barbarism and needs to be shut down. But people having holidays that their people have celebrated for millennia, that's cool stuff. It's mm-hmm. all a party, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very different. They're very different.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I think that, you know, your experience with being told that Christmas is not for you and you're not allowed to celebrate Christmas and only the fascists celebrate Christmas and
yeah.
you better be scared.
Yeah.
That's definitely weird. We didn't celebrate Hanukkah in my house and you didn't celebrate Christmas in your house. I don't think there's anything weird about that fact. Why would you celebrate Christmas? I mean, yeah. unless the kids come home and they're like, we really want to celebrate Christmas. And
yeah.
the parents are like, no.
Yeah.
That's for Christians and we don't like Christians.
Yeah.
But of course, Christmas is, you know, that's the problem with Christmas is it's kind of this liminal thing, you know. It's not mm-hmm. really just for Christians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But did you actually say to your parents, I want to celebrate Christmas?
I don't think so. Yeah, I don't remember, yeah. but I doubt
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, our son is in a blended family, so, you know, it's a specific situation for him.
Yeah.
Both things yeah. are available to him. Although, I don't know how much I want to celebrate Christmas. I mean, I'm cool with Christmas. I enjoyed Christmas as a kid. Christmas is a really fun holiday.
Yeah.
It's a killer holiday. There's no doubt about it. I mean, obviously, you know, it's just got a lot of really good. It's like really good shit in it. You know what I mean? No, it is.
Yeah.
It's like the big fat roly-poly guy in the red suit that comes down the chimney and gives you tons of toys under the tree. Like that's
yeah.
It's probably the greatest story. I mean, it is probably the great. I don't even know the story of Hanukkah. Isn't it just like a dismal story where like the Jews were stuck somewhere and they had to light a candle and it burned for 12 nights or something? And
yeah,
oh my gosh.
Pretty much. Yeah,
so I think it just doesn't.
But like,
smoke the way
you
Christmas
only
smokes.
Had enough candlelight for like so many days, but it lasted.
Yeah, I'm bored already. I'm a kid. I'm like bored. Yeah, but you tell me there's a dude who drives a sled with reindeer and goes down the chimney, man. I'm just like, what?
Yeah.
And he brings a present to every kid in the world everywhere, except for the bad ones. So it just rocks. But, you know, that said, whatever. If you want to celebrate it, he wants to celebrate it. I'll put on my Santa suit and go, ho, ho, ho. I do enjoy playing Santa.
I know you do, actually.
And I'm a killer that. Santa.
I know
I mean,
you are.
I am really one of the great Santas.
I know.
So. Anyway, okay. I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's a philosophy podcast for you. Wow. Ho, ho, ho. Good night to children everywhere.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.